Planned Parenthood Association versus Thomas Seuss. And we'll hear from you, Mr. Monson.
May it please the Court. Under the plain text of the administrative rules at issue in this case, these plaintiffs could continue to receive funding under the Women's Health Program, I'm going to call it WHP, if they did two things. Stop promoting abortion themselves and move that First Amendment activity into an affiliate entity, and stop sharing a name and trademark with an entity that provides or promotes abortion.
What? Say that. Say again. What now? The last thing.
The administrative rules don't require that their funding be cut off if they meet two requirements.
What is that?
That is, they can stop promoting abortion themselves and move that First Amendment activity into a related entity, which is what League of Women Voters says the government can require in this kind of spending program.
And require them to do it under a different name?
That's right. And the restriction on sharing the name is constitutional under West versus Sullivan's recognition that the government has the power to control what happens at the moment that WHP services are given to clients on the state's behalf.
This sounds like you're just throwing something in there that hasn't been thrown in.
Well, no, this has to have been thrown in there because it's the text of what the rule is. And we're on the PI standard, and it's their burden to show that something's going to happen to their rights.
The question here is just whether this preliminary injunction can be sustained.
Well, that's right. But this goes to the proper analysis to apply to the probable right of recovery analysis. And, we have a problem here. The district courts wrote application of the penalty analysis, which is foreclosed by Rust versus Sullivan, which says that in this kind of medical subsidy case, you don't apply penalty analysis. That's wrong. So you have to look at what the rule actually is to figure out whether there's a probable right that they're going to show that the administrative rules violate their First Amendment rights.
Well, I understand, but I also understand that there was no objection by you to the overbreadth of the injunction. Is that right?
Well, that's correct, but I don't think this goes to overbreadth. This is limited to whether they've met their burden to show a probable right.
He just basically enjoined the statute, and that the implication implementation of the statute that you were enjoined from the words of not used to perform or promote elective abortions, to contract with entities that perform or promote elective abortions or affiliate with entities that perform. Is that correct?
Well, that's correct, but the words promotion and affiliate have special definitions in this case, which are recognized in the order.
I understand. I just thought that the injunction may have been overbroad, but then to enjoin the promotion of it. But I didn't see that you objected to that.
Well, as we've explained, we did ask the trial court to narrow the scope of the preliminary injunction, and I believe that is probably before the court. But what I'm arguing now doesn't go to that overbreadth issue.
Okay, tell me what you're arguing.
I'm arguing that what we're doing, if you look at what the rule actually says, is as a matter of law consistent with the First Amendment, and therefore there's no probable right of recovery, and they can't get a preliminary injunction. And you know that if you look at the definitions that are in the rule that's being enjoined. There's two definitions that are at issue. Definition one, which is affiliate, it has three disjunctive requirements for being disqualified from WHP. There has to be shared control, a franchise agreement, or an agreement to share a name or a trade or service mark. Well, I think everyone agrees that the first two aren't at issue here. And so the question is whether the prohibition is on the requirement of sharing the trade or service mark violates the First Amendment. If it's constitutional to forbid a WHP affiliate from sharing a name and service mark in that way, then there is no probable right of recovery because the plaintiffs can accede to the requirements of the administrative rule. If they do that, then they won't have met any of the three requirements of the definition of affiliate.
You keep saying probable right of recovery. Is that your way of talking about likelihood of success on the merits?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm using the state court term of art. I apologize.
To hone in on how you're coming at this, the way you kind of started off, it's like sort of in the middle of a page.
Well, I wanted to get to the middle of the page, okay, because I think that there's been a lot of talk about different doctrines that kind of may or may not line up, and I would like to draw everybody's attention back to what the rules that are being enjoined actually say. If you don't share the name and trademark, you're not affiliated and you're not barred from being funded under the plain text of the rule. So the question is, does the First Amendment prevent us from foreclosing them from using a shared name or trademark between an abortion-providing entity and the WHP entity? And clearly under Rust versus Sullivan.
Is this an argument that you made before?
Well, yes. We made it in front of the district court. We said that the...
argued about the trademark and whether they would do it under a different name?
Well, of course we have. That's what the rule is about. I am focusing the court's attention on something that is admittedly buried in a long discussion of competing doctrines, but that's what this case is about. It's about what the rule says.
But normally we have an injunction in front of us, and, you know, I just have to say the way you're approaching this isn't the normal way that my brain is kind of focused on what I expect the way it's coming. We're certainly not trying to tell you how to do your argument, but it's a little harder to tune in exactly what you seem to be taking us into the intricacies of, you know, the act and the program, et cetera, as far as focusing on the injunction and whether or not we should sustain it and so forth. I guess you're going to get there. So
but the injunction enjoins the rule.
Right.
They have a probability of recovering based on what the injunction says, what the rule says. If, you know, and the core of their argument is that...
What is the rule?
The rule is section 354.1362 and 1363 of the Texas Administrative Code. That's what's being enjoined. It does not cut off their... They've suggested it several times in the brief that cuts off their ability to affiliate entirely. It does not. There is a route to continue to maintain affiliation and continue to receive WHP funding. So that cuts out their first argument on appeal as to why they have they're probably going to recover and are entitled to preliminary injunction. So there's two other points that they raise, and this is all in pages 9 and 10 of their appellant briefing. Their other two arguments are that the ban on them promoting abortion themselves by advertising or otherwise popularizing it, and the ban on their sharing a name or trademark with an entity that provides or promotes elective abortion violate the First Amendment. And
did you quote this rule in your brief?
We have referred to it in the brief. It is not laid out in full. It is laid out in full in the trial court in the trial court briefing, and I apologize for that. We probably should have included it as an appendix. But it is what the Texas Administrative Code currently says.
Is this what I have come to call the new rule, recently adopted in 2011?
Yes.
And you are saying that the requirements under that rule do not constitute violations of what the plaintiffs claim is their First Amendment rights?
Precisely.
Is that your contention?
Yes.
Now, tell me why that is your contention.
Two reasons, one for each of the two remaining issues in their appellate brief. First is the bar on them promoting abortion. League of Women Voters says that it is part of the government's power to circumscribe the scope of a spending program, that it can require a recipient entity to segregate core First Amendment activity into an affiliate entity in order to make sure that the entity receiving public funding doesn't do something that's contrary to the government's legitimate purpose in limiting the scope of what it decided to spend money on in the first place.
All right. You're saying that your new rule would prohibit all of these plaintiffs from furnishing abortion services in their clinics.
Well, That, yes. And it would also forbid them from popularizing or promoting abortion-related policy.
All right. Now, what does it prohibit them from using as their name for their service?
It's a subpart 1A, three small I's, 1A3, the granting or extension of a license or other agreement that authorizes the affiliate to use the other entity's brand name, trademark, service mark, or other registered identification mark.
So is that, if that rule were implemented, they would have to delete any reference to Planned Parenthood in the name of their clinic. Is that the situation?
That's right. They also, you know, they also couldn't have it on script forms or posters or materials that are out in the waiting room, those kinds of things.
Now, what was the last thing that you made reference to about trade name or trademark?
It's basically any identifying material that would link the abortion promoting or providing entity to the WHP entity. And that's a valid restriction under Russ versus Sullivan because the government has an interest in ensuring that the imprimatur of government services that's given when we provide these valuable services.
If they would change the name of the recipient as a recipient from Planned Parenthood to something else, that they would, that they would satisfy and could be affiliated with Planned Parenthood as long as they don't have the name, is that what?
That's what the rule says. The rule ends up predicating the bar on WHP funding entirely on the agreement to share the name and trademark.
Share what?
The name and or trademark. There's a list of things. A trademark, obviously, is what we think of as a trademark. A service mark is a term of art within Medicaid. They're basically just ways of identifying the entities that are providing the services. And the state has the ability to restrict how a WHP entity identifies itself when it is providing services to Texas citizens in order to avoid providing the imprimatur of the state's approval to the related abortion providing facility.
Now, let me ask a question. There are, as I understand it, 9 different plaintiffs in this case.
That's right.
And they are each a corporate entity.
That's right.
Separate from each other.
That's correct.
And were they organized corporations under the law of Texas?
Well, I'm not sure actually of their legal corporate identity, but I do know that they are set up in this kind of, in a looser affiliation standard than what you call the new rule requires. So the question really is whether these two incremental increases in the amount of separation that's required between affiliate entities violates the First Amendment. If it doesn't, then they can't show that they're going to recover and they're not entitled to a preliminary injunction.
Can you refer to me to the part of your brief where you make the argument that you're making now?
It is implied by we repeatedly argue.
Is that a section of your brief where you say
it doesn't have its own heading? But it is in the proportion of the brief where we talk about how the rule is justified because it governs activity within the program.
So you are admittedly enlarging the argument here on appeal.
Quite the contrary. Quite the contrary. We are narrowing our argument in order.
Then what I would ask is, if this argument is a winning argument that you have chosen to argue on appeal, why is it not designated? Why have I got to go through the entire brief and try to pick out where you make this argument?
Your Honor, this case has been briefed on an emergency basis.
On what?
It's been an emergency basis. We've only had a week to do the briefs.
Okay.
All of this came up within a few days, and we now see the wisdom of focusing our argument more narrowly than we did. I don't think this is broadening the argument. We're actually sloughing off I stand by what we've said in the brief. I think we have the ability to do everything constitutionally as we've discussed it. But for purposes of argument, I'm trying to narrow the court's attention on the crux of what the preliminary injunction is about, and the fact that we can validly require them to.
I understand the argument, and I thought about it, about if the state has the right to present an unmuddled statement of policy, that if Planned Parenthood is receiving these funds and you walk in to Planned Parenthood and you go to the left door to receive these services and you go to the right door to get an abortion, that the message the state is trying to send is muddled.
That's right.
But I certainly didn't think you had made an argument like that in the briefs.
Oh, no, we do. We make that argument in both the appellant's brief and the reply brief.
I'll see if I can find it between the lines.
Is it the state's?
You can't tell me where you find where it is.
When I come back on rebuttal, I'll give you the page numbers. I just don't have them memorized. But I will have that for you when I come back up.
Ordinarily, people start off their argument with their strongest argument. You know, this brief is 65 pages, and it's got a whole lot of subparts. And
mm-hmm.
You said it was expedited appeal, but for me, that's no excuse. But that's your strongest argument of why 75 pages plus the amicus. I mean, the purpose of oral argument is to aid the panel. We had to read it in a hurry, too. But at any event, it is what it is, as they say on the street.
I am trying to help the panel, Judge Stewart, by narrowing the focus of what you have to deal with. I don't think that you want to.
Well, we always appreciate help.
Okay, let me just ask you a very succinct way to tell me, to describe this argument that you are making now.
Mm-hmm.
And then I want you to tell me where you made it in your brief when you come back.
Okay.
Tell me what the argument is.
The argument is now that there are two things that are wrong with there are two things that they claim are wrong with the rules.
They claim what?
They have three arguments in their appeal. The first is that it's impossible for them to affiliate, so this is a violation of League of Women Voters. I'm pointing out that that's not true because it's possible for them to continue to affiliate if they comply with the other two requirements of the rule. The other two requirements of the rule are, on their face, valid under the First Amendment, because League of Women Voters says you can place a condition on spending that requires the recipient entity to create an affiliate entity to carry out core First Amendment activity. So we are on all fours with the First Amendment in requiring them not to promote abortion within the definition that's in the rule. And the second thing is the limitation on the name, shared name or trademark. And as we've said at every stage of these proceedings, the state's ability to control what happens when social services provided to citizens on the state's behalf extends to controlling what information is provided in the course of the provision of those social services in order to avoid muddling the government's message or creating the appearance that the government's imprimatur is being given to an abortion-providing or promoting entity.
Okay. Thank you.
May it please the court.
Of course not, yeah.
This is a classic First Amendment unconstitutional conditions case, which the Supreme Court has dealt with time and time again in contexts that range from public radio to legal services to the very issue here, speech related to abortion. And those cases, Regan, FCC, most notably Russ versus Sullivan, uniformly hold that while the government need not fund speech that it disfavors, and the government may take steps to ensure that its funds are spent as they are meant to be spent, the one thing it cannot do is to bar entirely an entity from participating in that program because that entity outside of that program and with its own private funds exercises its First Amendment rights.
Now, what language in the rule do you say would compel you to do that if the rule is enforced?
Judge DeMoss, the rule bars our participation in WHP in far more ways than counsel for the state has said here today. The rule can be found on pages 59 and 60 of the record. That's where the actual rule is. You're looking for it. And the rule doesn't just bar plaintiffs from promoting abortion. It bars them from affiliating with entities that promote abortion. And the definition of affiliate, it is specific and it is detailed, and it bars them not from using the service mark, which is what counsel for the first time stood up here saying is what is barred. It bars them from having a license to use it, even if they don't use it. And the way that Planned
Now, what is the difference from your standpoint in having a license and using it and having a license and not using it? Who is that imposition on?
Plaintiffs cannot be member affiliates of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. They are subject to standards and bylaws, standards of affiliation, that demonstrate some common control and that also grant them a license to use the service mark.
But now, I mean, can you understand that if an individual who is seeking the general health services provided by Planned Parenthood walks into an office, clinic that says Planned Parenthood, and then you walk to the left and you get these services, the general services, and you walk to the right and you get abortion, that the state's message that the money shall not be spent for abortions or the promotion of abortions is muddled.
Your Honor, WHP is a fee-for-service reimbursement program. In providing medical services, WHP providers aren't engaging in speech, and there is no message.
But you're not going to answer my question.
No, Your Honor. The purpose of WHP is to provide family planning services, and the name Planned Parenthood could not be more compatible with the purposes of this program.
Yeah, except Planned Parenthood, of all the names in the entire country that one could come up with that stands for the right of abortion and fights for the right of abortion, is Planned Parenthood. I mean, that's just like
and saying, performs more abortion.
I mean, what if just say it was not Planned Parenthood, and say it was Abortion Inc. That was the name of the organization, and it you walked into the door, Abortion Inc. And Abortion Inc. into the left says we provide non-abortion services. To the right, abortion services at Abortion Inc. Don't you think that the message that the state is trying to send has been muddled?
Well, Your Honor's assumption is that Planned Parenthood can be banned because they're good at advocating for what they do. That they're good at.
I understand that. I'm not quite agree with that. I'm not fussing about that.
Well, and the Supreme Court made clear just 2 years ago in Citizens United that
they're arguing about this, the right of the state to. Make its own statement in a clear and unmuddled way in terms of the grant.
I have two important responses, if I can get to both of them, Your Honor. One is that the Supreme Court made clear in Citizens United 2 years ago that's exactly what the First Amendment prohibits. Quote, restrictions distinguishing among different speakers, allowing speech by some but not by others. And the reason it said that is, quote, speech restrictions that are based on the identity of the speaker are all too often simply a means to control the content.
Nobody's doing that. In other words, it's a term of the grant. It's not imposing a prohibition on individuals. It's imposing it as a term of the grant, which the state is permitted to do.
Your Honor, the district court properly found that it would bar plaintiff's association with Planned Parenthood, but this is about an issue.
Oh, it would, if you had another name that you and you actually perform these services separate from Planned Parenthood, you can certainly affiliate with Planned Parenthood.
Well, to be clear, they do perform them separately. That was the subject of this court's opinion in Sanchez. All of the plaintiffs here are legally and financially separate and audited by the state to ensure that they are from any provision of abortion services. None of the plaintiffs provide abortion services.
But let me ask, are any of these plaintiffs here performing services at the same clinic as the abortions are being performed?
In this, at the same time they see patients or in the same physical structure?
In the same physical structure.
I believe that some are, yes. And that has never been held to be a problem under any precedent.
I mean, it just occurs to me that if an individual is the recipient, I mean, is the participant in the plan and receiving the benefits, I'm talking about the individuals, the citizens of the state of Texas, that are going to take advantage of this benefit that the state has given to them, go into Planned Parenthood where they also perform abortions. It's certainly not clear that the state of Texas does not wish to associate its funds or itself with abortion.
Well, this is about the First Amendment, and First Amendment, a restriction must be narrowly tailored. And so if the state, even if the state had a compelling interest in that court sort of separation, it could require signs, it could require a disclosure. And this is identical to Rust. This is identical to Rust versus Sullivan. And in terms of, it was a family planning provider, and some of the plaintiffs in Rust were Planned Parenthoods.
I mean, you and I are just going like two ships in the dark past each other, so I'll let you just go ahead and make the argument that you've got there, but it's not addressing the concerns that I have. But go ahead.
I think that my answers to the concerns that you have are three. One, the rule, actual text of the rule on page 59 bars plaintiffs from the participation even if they don't use the name Planned Parenthood. The state has stood here today and rewritten the rule. Two, that your construct is an impermissible First Amendment restriction on the identity of the speaker. And three, it's not narrowly tailored, which the First Amendment requires on this kind of speech, which is at the heart of the First Amendment, a matter of public concern. Every single case speaks of one voice. This is not the first time someone has tried to take Planned Parenthood out of a family planning program. This happened in Sanchez. This happened in the Eighth Circuit's opinion in Dempsey. This happened in the Ninth Circuit's opinion in Planned Parenthood of Arizona case. There were four district courts this year who considered this, and there are prior district courts as well. And every one of those courts reached the same conclusion as the district court here. They reached the same conclusion. They all are of one voice. The government may set parameters on its program, but it can't bar someone from outside that program exercising its constitutional rights. And the text of that rule.
You want to talk about the right of the individual and the First Amendment. Now, what the state wants to talk about is state-sponsored speech. And you're talking about a completely different argument. You're not even responding at all to the argument that the state is making.
This is the Medicaid program. There is no speech. This is not a message program. There are programs we could imagine where women would come in and be counseled. But this is not a message program. Women who get WHP services, the purpose of WHP, it's defined by statute. The statute says, quote, the purpose is to expand access to preventive health and family planning services for women.
Without having an abortion. Isn't that part of the same declaration?
They will not, absolutely, they will not fund abortion. And when women come, they are not received any message. And plaintiff's conduct is 100% in line with any goals and message.
If somebody comes in to Planned Parenthood, and they come to the desk, and they say, okay, do you want an abortion or do you want regular services?
I do not believe that's what happened. I believe they call and they schedule an appointment, and they say, I'd like a family planning appointment, just as they do at any hospital. Let's talk about the rules exemption of
Is a family planning appointment a euphemism for an abortion, or is it a euphemism for the general health services?
Family planning is birth control services.
Is what?
Birth control services. Contraception.
Not abortion.
Correct. Okay. And that's what all the plaintiffs do. And especially, there are 49 health centers here. Most of those health centers, I do not have the exact numbers, but the overwhelming majority of those health centers don't perform abortions at all. They are only WHP entities. And so when you call and they say, no one says, would you like an abortion? They call and they say, can I help you? If a woman says, do you want an abortion? Then they say, we don't provide that here. They may say, you can go somewhere else. But if they call in the WHP program and they say, I am a WHP patient, and they ask for an abortion, they are told we do not refer for abortion because that's what the WHP rules actually require. We follow the rules of the program, and absolutely they can set rules on the program. There is no question that they can set rules for their program.
Let me ask a couple of questions. Where in relation to distance are the two forms of services that Planned Parenthood provides? Are they all in the same building at the same street address? Or is the family planning services a block away from the building where the abortion services are planned.
Your Honor, this is just not in the record in the preliminary injunction appeal. I'm going to do my best with what I know of the facts. I think it varies. There are 49 health centers that participate.
Well, the further away they are, the better it would seem to me everything would be.
Well, there has never been an actual physical separation requirement. In Rust, physical separation was actually one of the factors that was considered as on a non-exhaustive list of factors. But let me also just point out, this rule doesn't talk about physical separation. Physical separation is nowhere in this rule.
But what I heard from opposing counsel is that you are saying there are requirements in the rule that the drafters of the rule say is not there.
The court can read the rule, and they can promulgate a rule. The rule clearly bars any common ownership, management, or control with anyone who has a service license to use the service mark Planned Parenthood, who provides abortion, who advocates for abortion.
Okay, and all of those prohibited connections are where there is, in fact, an abortion facility that provides abortions.
No, it has nothing to do with facilities. We have 49 women's health providing sites in the state of Texas.
And all 49 are included under the 9 plaintiffs that are in this case?
Correct. And most of those plaintiffs have one or most 2 sites at which they provide abortions. So
let me ask you right there. I ask counsel, are these Texas corporations?
Yes, every one of
them. And they have separate boards of directors?
Yes, the Sanchez requirements
and separate officers?
Yes.
Okay.
They're listed in our brief, and they're also actually now in statute.
But what you say they are entitled to keep if they want to keep getting funds from the state is the name Planned Parenthood. Is that where you really say you're asking us to give up something that really hurts us?
Well, I'm not sure what hurts you. I'm asking you to look at the rule that was enacted and that the rule
hurts you. I'm assuming that you are speaking not only for the 9 plaintiffs, but for whatever the relationship with Planned Parenthood nationwide is with these 9 plaintiffs. Is that correct?
Yes. These 9 plaintiffs have a First Amendment right to be associated with Planned Parenthood. And the facts in the case
If they have a right to do that, do they have a right to do that if they want to take funds that prohibit them from having an abortion as part of their services?
They do, because this is political speech that's at the heart of the First Amendment, and a restriction could be much more narrowly tailored.
Where in the rule issued by the Texas Administrative Agency do you find that requirement?
The requirement of not having the name?
Not being able to use the name.
They can't have any written instrument that shows any management by an entity, including standards of affiliation, with an entity that advocates for women's right to choose, which is Planned Parenthood Federation of America, the parent organization.
And I assume that is a national corporation, probably organized under the laws of Delaware. Is that right?
I don't know where Planned Parenthood Federation of America is incorporated. It's headquartered in New York, I believe. But I don't know. I don't know where it is incorporated.
But you say that the enforcement of the new rule would deprive you of what constitutional right?
Our right to freedom of speech that is conducted through a separate affiliate, and our right to freedom of association to associate with others who use the name Planned Parenthood. And to be clear, it's not just Planned Parenthood Federation of America. What the state has now said is plaintiff, so here's one of the plaintiffs is called Planned Parenthood of Austin Family Planning Services. If Planned Parenthood of Austin Family Planning Services, that entity actually does not engage in any advocacy already to begin with. If that entity dropped the Planned Parenthood and called itself Austin Family Planning Services, the rule would bar it from WHP because it has the license to use the Planned Parenthood name, even if it doesn't use it, and also because it's affiliated with entities, shares agreements, common management and control, with entities that advocate on behalf of a woman's right to choose.
what common management and control exists among what you've told me are separate Texas corporate entities with separate boards of director and separate officers.
For example, a management agreement. They're not complete silos. They operate, they have some common management or control. Each one has a slightly different corporate structure, which has been approved by the state as part of the Sanchez settlement. But they have, for example, they have common people who sit on the board. They have a management agreement. They have, someone may lease a building, or they may have a personnel agreement that on
and
Tuesdays.
Does the management agreement say personnel from the clinic that provides abortion will come in and frequently manage affairs in the clinic that is not to provide abortion?
Your Honor, there's 9 plaintiffs and 49 health centers, but yes, they do have agreements that some physicians or nurses will both staff a WHP entity, and not at the same time, but so on Tuesdays may staff a WHP clinic, and on Wednesdays may be at another site staffing another program or not program.
Okay, go ahead. Proceed with your argument.
I just want to be sort of clear about one other thing that the state now says that the rule allows, which is that we concede that under Rust and SCC and Regan and this court's decision in Sanchez, the controlling cases, that plaintiffs can be made to move or separate any advocacy that now occurs within that entity. But the rule bars that affiliation. The rule does not just bar plaintiffs from advocating, it bars them from affiliating. It closes the constitutional safety valve that the Supreme Court and every single court, every appellate court, every district court who's looked at this question has reached one conclusion, one voice. You need to leave it separate. And when we're left with the name, which I understand that Your Honors are struggling with, I respond as we have, which is that there are more narrowly tailored ways. The rule bars the name.
Do you understand what your opponent has said? He's not even arguing with you about this, about affiliates. I mean, as I understand what he's saying is, he says that under the rules here, you can affiliate. You can affiliate with someone, not with Planned Parenthood under your name, but you can affiliate.
But that's not what the rule says, Your Honor. He can promulgate. I understand he says that now. It was never said before. It was never said before, 10:15 this morning or whatever or whatnot. But if he wanted to promulgate that rule, we would be here arguing about this rule. What we're here on now, about that rule, excuse me. What we're here on now is we're arguing about this rule, which is at pages 59 and 60 of the supplement, and this rule clearly falls on the impermissible side of the divide that every single case to look at something has fallen on. And what the district court did on a preliminary injunction, this is whether we have a likelihood of success. This is not a developed record on the questions that about the name and what women see when they walk in and the personnel and the management agreements. This is not a developed record. This is a preliminary injunction. And what this court said is all of the cases to consider this speak of only one voice, and it all falls on the side of plaintiffs here.
All right. Thank you very much. We have a rebuttal. Let me ask you why this appeal may not be moot. In fact, the case may be moot.
Mm-hmm.
And that is because the statute that authorizes this rule that has been enjoined says that the funds will be appropriated for the Health and Human Services Commission contingent on receiving a waiver from the HHS shall provide the woman's health program services under the Medicaid to women.
Mm-hmm.
And the Health and Human Services, the waiver has been denied. And so consequently, under this specific funding of the state legislature, it's not going to happen.
Well, I'm afraid that's factually not quite right. The waiver is actually in effect, according to their 28J letter. The new information from the federal government is that the waiver is still in place.
Until November.
Well, actually, until the preliminary injunction, there's some back and forth on this, but it's not sure when it's going to wind down.
Well, why don't we just hold it to see whether there's going to be any funding for this?
Because we'd be laboring under an improper preliminary injunction during all the rest
could
of that
you
time.
Do what?
We would be subject to an improper preliminary injunction preventing us from carrying out what the legislature intended during the pendency of the lawsuit when they can't show that they're actually being deprived of any First Amendment rights. That's why.
Well, you have a waiver. You have a waiver until November, don't you?
Well, it might be long. We don't know for sure when the waiver is going to end. The way it works is once they decide to end the waiver finally in the administrative.
You don't have the injunction pending against you.
That's right. That's
okay,
right.
Go ahead.
And they've attacked the statute also, contingent, so it might not moot out the case anyway.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, and I just wanted to point out our Rust argument is pages 29 through 31 of our opening brief.
Wait a minute, say it again.
Our Rust versus Sullivan argument about the fact that we can control the content of the program is at pages 29 through 31 of our opening brief.
29 through 31.
Our argument that League of Women Voters allows us to require them to move all of their promotion activity into an affiliate is at pages 31 through 34. And our argument that that the use of their name in this program would muddle the message of the program and mess up the state's funding priorities is at pages 41 through 50 of the brief. And all of those arguments are summarized again at pages 19 through 23 of the reply brief.
Okay.
I'd like to just finish up real quick talking about what the purpose of the statute and the rule are. You know, we've attached a copy of the actual statute to the reply brief. And what it says is, women's health program, here are seven categories of health services we want you to provide, that's subsection A. Subsection H says, no provision or promotion of abortion. That is the purpose of this rule, and that is the purpose of the women's health program statute. As you pointed out, Judge Jolly, this is really about the scope of the government's ability to maintain clarity in showing what it has decided to fund and what it has decided not to fund from the get-go. You know, as the footnote 5 of Rust versus Sullivan says, when you have this kind of voluntary program where somebody's coming in and providing services on the government's behalf, you can't say it's automatically a penalty on speech because they are choosing to engage in the program in the first place. If you choose to do something knowing that there are conditions on it, it isn't a penalty on free speech. It's your own choice to give up those activities and put them into an affiliate organization.
Oh, well, I mean, Ross makes clear, I mean, they've got to have an avenue to express their opinions.
Well, and
they can do it through an affiliate.
That's right.
That's all I was going to mention.
Exactly, exactly.
But you can put these conditions on the actual recipient. Or actually, you can make that the terms of the grant, so long as there's a vow for them to express themselves through an affiliate.
Yes, that's our point. Yeah. And that's the point of all the arguments that we've made today boil down to that simple point.
Well, I've thought about this too. I mean, it gets rather convoluted about whose rights are being
counseled
and whose are not.
It sounds to me like that events are occurring in and between the state government and Planned Parenthood and the national funding that have taken no notice of whatever may be the injunctive relief that's been granted in this case. Is that true?
Well, I'm not entirely sure what you mean, Judge DeMoss.
I'm just operating from the premise that the district judge issued an injunction against the director of the state program and his office mm-hmm. and employees from taking any actions to implement the resolution, the new resolution, the new requirement. Is that true?
Well, as we read the injunction, it requires us to keep these plaintiffs in the program without applying the rule. I don't think that we've gotten to the point where we've started applying it to anybody who isn't one of the plaintiffs yet. But the result of the injunction is that we are continuing to fund them for their funding requests.
Thank you very much. That completes the arguments that we have on the oral argument calendar for the week, so this panel stands adjourned.